he in the night 10 feet away on the other side of the car? He would know Jim anywhere, knew him by the way his arms hung at his sides. He recognized the curve of his bare skull against the smoky night.
"Jim!"
Kellaway cried, in a voice he hardly recognized as his own.
"Jim, that you?"
Jim took a slow, heavy step toward him, and Kellaway had to shut his eyes, could not bear to see the man in the darkness at the edge of the road. His fear drove the breath out of him. He had not been half as scared when he'd crawled into Devotion Diamonds toward a woman with a gun. He heard Jim take another step toward him and forced himself to open his eyes. His eyes had adjusted to the dark by then, and he saw in a moment that what he'd taken for a man was the stunted black mangrove. The curve he'd imagined to be Jim Hurst's bare skull was nothing more than a smooth knob where a branch had broken away long ago. The plastic hanging off the house flapped heavily again, sounding like a man taking slow, heavy steps. Kellaway exhaled. A crazy thing to think, that Jim was walking with him in the dark. And yet, even as he continued toward the house, he could not quite escape the feeling of having company. The night was in restless motion, branches flinging themselves frantically back and forth. The grass hissed. The wind was rising. He rapped at the doorframe and called for Jim, called for Mary. But he was not surprised when no one answered him. For some reason, he had not expected a reply. He let himself in. Beneath the campfire smell that was on everything, Kellaway caught the odor of stale, flat beer and urine. He flicked on the light in the foyer.
"Hello?"
He looked into the living room. Monster trucks were racing on the TV, lunging over great muddy hills. No one was there.
"Jim?"
He called again. He peeked into the kitchen. Empty. By then, he knew what he was going to find before he found it. He could not have said why. Maybe he'd even known out in the driveway, when he sensed Jim close to him in the darkness. He did not want to look into the master bedroom, but couldn't help himself. The lights were off. Jim was lying on the bed, his wheelchair parked beside it. Kellaway clicked on the light, but only for a moment. He didn't want to look. He flipped the switch, and it was dark again. After a moment, Kellaway walked over to the bed and sat down in the wheelchair. The room was fragrant with the sharp copper reek of blood. It was a filthy place to die. Diapers stuffed into a plastic trash pail, beer cans on the floor, orange pill bottles and pornographic magazines on the bedside table. Just a few feet from the bed was a closet. Kellaway switched on the closet light. That made it possible for him to see, while casting a more merciful glow on the man under the sheet. Jim Hurst, with a .44 in his mouth, and his brain sprayed all over the headboard. He died with some of his birthday scotch left, the bottle still a quarter full. Jim had set it on the pillow next to him, as if he knew Kellaway would be by later, and wanted to return it to him. He'd clothed himself in the jacket of his dress uniform, his purple heart pinned to his breast. He hadn't bothered with a shirt, though, and the sheets were pulled up to just below the big slope of his belly. When Kellaway reached across Jim's body for the scotch, his sleeve brushed a sheet of ruled paper. He caught it, sat back, held it up to read it by the closet light. He was not at all surprised to see that the note was addressed to him. "Rand. Hey, brother. If you're the one who finds me, and I hope you are, I'm sorry about the mess. I just couldn't hang in there anymore. About 3 months ago, I dropped in on my doc for a routine checkup, and he didn't like the sound of my chest. The x-ray spotted a shadow in my right lung. He said we should follow up. I said I'd think about it. And I did think about it. And what I thought is, fuck it. I can't stand the smell of my own piss anymore. There's nothing good on TV. And Mary's gone. In a way, she's been gone for almost a year. She was still spending the days here so she could look after me. But she'd take off at bedtime to visit a guy she met at work. She spends most nights with him, and when she comes home, I can smell it on her. I can smell she's been fucking him. A couple of days ago, she made it official. Told me it was time for her to move out. No one ought to live this way. Sometimes I put my gun in my mouth and I'm surprised how good it feels. How much I like the taste. I've eaten Mary's pussy 1,000 times, and I'll tell you what, I'd rather go down on a 44. It's like that joke for teasing vegetarians. If God didn't want us to eat animals, he shouldn't have made them so tasty. If Colt didn't want us to eat a pistol, they shouldn't have made gun oil so tasty. I think it was what happened at the mall finally made me brave enough to do this thing. When it mattered, you had the balls to stand up and put a bullet where you knew it could do some good. You were ready to die to stop something that needed stopping. And that's how I feel too, man. I can't live like this anymore. It needs to stop, and I need to be brave enough to stop it, to put a bullet where it can do some good. I couldn't have done this if I had to figure out how to hang myself or if I had to cut my wrists and bleed out slow. I know I couldn't. I'd lose my nerve at the last minute. My brain is my enemy. Thank God there's a way to switch it off quick. Oh, hey, if you want any of my weapons, they're all yours. I know you'll appreciate them and take care of them. Ha ha ha. Why don't you test them out on Mary? You make it look like I killed her in a murder-suicide, and I'll gay-marry you in heaven. Not being gay at all when I say I love you, Rand. You were the only person who ever came to visit me. You were the only person who cared. We had some times, didn't we? Best, Jim Hurst. Earlier, when Kellaway was outside, it had seemed to him that Jim was close, that his old friend was somehow, impossibly, walking alongside him. Now he felt Jim near him again. He wasn't in the bed. That was just ruined meat and thickening, cooling blood. Kellaway thought he could see Jim at the edge of his vision, just outside the doorway, a big dark shape lurking in the corridor. Before, the idea of Jim walking alongside him had frightened him, but now it didn't bother Kellaway at all. He was instead comforted by the notion.
"It's all right, brother," he said to Jim. "It's all right now."
He folded the note and put it in his pocket. He uncorked the scotch and had a swallow. It blazed inside him. For the first time since the morning of the mall shooting, he felt calm, centered. He was sure if their positions had been reversed, he would have shot himself years and years before, but he was glad Jim got there eventually. He did not think it would be best to be the person who discovered the body. Let Mary find him, or Jim's sister, or anyone. If the press connected him with yet another gunshot victim, well, what had Rickles told him? They'd make a meal out of him for sure. But Kellaway was in no rush to leave. No one was coming by Jim Hurst's house at nearly 10 in the evening. No one was going to bother the two of them. It was good scotch, and Kellaway had slept on Jim's couch before. And besides, before he left in the morning, he could step into the garage and have a look at Jim's guns.
9:32 p.m.
She heard her cell phone ringing and kissed Dorothy on the nose, stepped out of her daughter's dark bedroom and into the hall. She got it on the third ring, didn't recognize the number. "Lantern Glass," she said. "Placenti Digest. What's up?"
"I don't know,"
called a merry voice with a faint Latin accent through the hiss of a signal bouncing off a satellite a third of the way around the world.
"You called me. Lauren Acosta, Sheriff's Department. Woo!"
That woo didn't seem to be directed at her. Other people were wooing in the background.
"Thanks for returning my call. You're in Alaska?"
"Yeah. We got whales breaching here. Woo!" Off on the other end of the line, from up in the Arctic Circle, Lantern Glass heard yells and scattered applause and a sound like someone playing ugly notes on a tuba.
"I hate to interrupt your vacation. Do you want to watch your whales and call me another time?"
"No. I can talk and still admire a 30-ton sexy beast doing backflips."
"What kind of whales?" asked Dorothy.
She had crept to her bedroom door and stood holding the doorframe, staring into the hall, her eyes glittering at the bottom of dark hollows. She was wearing a red and white striped nightcap that looked like it had been swiped from Waldo.
None of your business, Lantern Glass said. Get back in bed.
What did you say? Acosta asked.
Sorry, I was speaking to my daughter. She's excited about your whales.
What kind?
Humpbacks, a pod of 18.
Humpbacks, Lantern Glass repeated. Now scoot.
I have to pee,
Dorothy announced primly, and sashayed past her mother down the hall and into the bathroom. She clapped the door shut behind her.
Lauren, I'm calling about Randall Kellaway. You've probably heard...
Oh, that guy. Lantern Glass stiffened, felt a curious crawling sensation up her spine as if someone had breathed on the nape of her neck.
You know him? Did you serve papers on him?
Yeah, I delivered the restraining order. I had to collect up about half his arsenal. My partner, Paulie, got the rest out of his house. Guy owned a fully automatic Uzi. He drove around with it. You know what kind of person drives around with an Uzi in his car? The evil henchman in a James Bond movie.
What's up with Kellaway? I hope he didn't shoot anyone.
Lantern Glass leaned against the wall.
Holy shit, you don't know?
Know what?
Oh, no.
Acosta said, all the pleasant hilarity draining from her voice. In the background, someone blew that awful note on a tuba again. Please tell me he didn't kill his wife, or his little boy.
Why would you think that?
That's why we took the guns. He had a bad habit of pointing them at people in his family. This one time, his wife took their son over to his sister's house to watch a movie. She left a note for him, but it fell off the fridge, so Kellaway didn't find it when he got back from work. He began to think maybe she took off on him. When she finally got home, Kellaway pulled his little boy up into his lap and asked her if she knew what he'd do if she ever really left him. And he pointed a gun at his son's head and said, "Bang." Then he pointed a gun at her and winked. He's a grade-A fucking psycho. The kid isn't dead, is he?
No, it's nothing like that.
Lantern Glass told her about the mall. By the time she finished, Dorothy was out of the bathroom, leaning against the wall beside her, cheek resting against her hip.
Back to bed,
Lantern Glass mouthed. Dorothy didn't move, pretended she didn't understand. Acosta said,
"Huh. Did he have an exception that would have allowed him to carry a gun in his place of work for his job?
Not a mall cop. If he was a real cop, maybe. Or a soldier. I don't know. You'd have to track down the transcripts of his hearing. I checked the public records website, and there was nothing in there about a divorce order.
No, there wouldn't be. He never got divorced. The wife is very timid,
got a case of Stockholm syndrome. He didn't allow her to have her own cell phone for years, or her own email account. The only reason she left him is that she's more scared of her sister than she is of her husband. And the restraining order would be filed with the courthouse. You can't pull that offline. I can get someone to email you a copy of the injunction if you want. Tomorrow, day after. Lantern Glass was quiet, thinking it through. She'd need to see a court transcript before Tim would let her run with the allegation that Kellaway had pointed a gun at his wife and child. But she could at least get something in tomorrow's edition about the restraining order. Get it out that he'd been forbidden to carry a weapon after...
What?
Menacing his wife and child? Menacing was a safe verb, she thought. Tim might let her have menacing.
Yeah, Lantern Glass said. I'd appreciate that. But if it's all right, I'd like to squeeze something into tomorrow's edition about this. A source within the sheriff's department says,
Oh, the hell with that. Use my name. Even better, see if you can get my picture. I love to see my face in the paper.
It's all right to directly source you?
By all means. Kellaway and I really hit it off the one time we met. I'm sure he'll be delighted to hear I'm still thinking about him.
The tuba wailed.
Is that a foghorn? Lantern Glass asked.
That's a whale, Acosta yelled.
There was more cheering in the background.
They're serenading us.
Lantern Glass didn't know how Dorothy heard what Acosta was saying, but all at once she was jumping up and down.
Can I hear? Can I listen? Ms. Acosta, my daughter is wondering if you'd hold your phone up so she can hear the whales.
Put her on!
Lantern Glass lowered her phone and pressed it to Dorothy's ear and stood and watched her daughter. 8 years old, eyes very large, face calm, attentive, listening while the world sang to her.
July 13, 8:42 a.m. Kellaway woke before nine, peeled himself off the couch, and padded into the bathroom to take a leak. When he came back, 10 minutes later, with toast and coffee, his own wide, bristly, impassive face was on the TV, above a chyron that said, "Gunning for Trouble." He had passed out with the television going and the volume turned all the way down, had slept heavily and well in that silent flicker of uncanny light. He had felt easier with a gun again, had drifted off with Jim's British Webley and Scott on the floor beside him. He sat on the edge of the couch now, unconsciously holding the gun in one hand and the remote in the other. He turned up the volume. Heels of the story that Randall Kellaway was released from the Army after allegations that he repeatedly used excessive force in his stint with the military police, said the morning news anchor. He talked in the style popularized by Wolf Blitzer, in fragmentary sentences with emphasis on any word that was reasonably dramatic. Now, the St. Vicente Digest, out with a shock report that Kellaway was forbidden to possess a firearm because of threats he made against his wife and young son. Sheriff Sergeant Lauren Acosta confirming to the Digest that Kellaway would not have been granted an exception to carry a weapon because of his job as a mall security guard, and that possession of the .327 would have been a clear violation of the injunction against him. No word yet why Mrs. Kellaway applied for the injunction, or the nature of the threats leveled against her by her husband. Mr. Kellaway and the St. Vicente police have yet to return our calls for comment. But we expect Chief Rickles to make a statement today when he appears at the Miracle Falls Mall for an 11 a.m. candle lighting ceremony to remember the fallen in the recent attack. Randall Kellaway is scheduled to light the first candle and may also comment. We don't know, but we'll be there live to cover. It was her, of course. It was the black Lantern Glass, who had turned up yesterday evening to ambush him when he walked out of the local TV studio. She couldn't leave him alone. She didn't care if he ever saw his kid again. For her, he was just a character in a nasty story that she could use to sell some papers. He had not dared to admit to himself until now that a part of him had begun to believe he could leverage his sudden unexpected celebrity into getting it all back. Holly and George, sure, but something else, too. His rights were the words that came to him, but that was and wasn't quite it. It wasn't his right to have a gun, or not just his right to a gun. That was only part of it. It seemed to him that there was something obscene about an America where a grinning Latina could tell him to stay away from his own son, and never mind he worked 50 hours a week, never mind what he had sacrificed as a soldier representing his nation in a hostile foreign land. The thought of that tiny black woman grinning at him while she poked her cell phone in his face, asking him her loaded questions, made him feel feverish. It seemed grotesque that he lived in a society where someone like that could make a living out of humiliating him. She didn't care that George would hear on the TV that his father was a sick man who pointed guns at his own family. She didn't care what kids said to George at school, if he got teased and harassed. Lantern Glass had decided he was a criminal from the moment she laid eyes on him. He was white and male. Obviously, he was a criminal. Kellaway clicked off the TV. Tires ground on gravel outside. He rose, twitched aside the curtain, and saw Mary, pulling into the drive in a banana-colored RAV4 that he didn't recognize. Coils of smoke, unwound from the tops of the palms, turned to golden froth in the early light. Kellaway left the Webley on the couch. He opened the door as she drew to a stop and shut off the RAV. "What you doing here?" she asked.
"Could say the same to you."
She stood at the front end of the RAV, scrawny and sinewy in a pair of cut-off jeans and a man's flannel shirt. She held one hand over her eyes as if to shield them from the sun, although there was no particular glare.
"Get a couple of my things," she said.
"He told you?"
"I know about it," Killaway said. "You took it easy, living off his insurance money till it was all used up, then figured you'd jump ship, huh?"
She said, "You think changing his diapers and pumping up his cock every night is taking it easy? You do it for a while." Killaway shook his head and said,
"I don't know about changing his diapers, but can you come in here and show me where the urine bags are? The one he's got on now burst, and there's piss all over the place."
"Oh, Jesus," she said. "Jesus Christ. How much did you let him drink last night?"
"Too much, I guess."
"Hire the fucking handicapped. I'll fix it."
"Thanks,"
he said, stepping back into the house.
"I'll meet you in the bedroom."
9:38 a.m. After it was done and she was on the floor with a hole where her right eye had been, Kellaway put Jim's .44 in Mary's own hand. He sat for a while on the edge of the bed, his wrists resting on his knees. The ringing echo of the shot seemed to throb inside him, to reverberate long after it should have faded. He felt switched off inside, blank. She'd been crying as she stared into the barrel. She had offered to suck his cock, snot bubbling out of her nose. Some tears and snot were good. It would look like she'd been weeping when she shot herself. How would the cops take it? Maybe they'd figure that after discovering the body of her former lover, she'd decided to join him in the afterlife, a shabby, scrawny Juliet racing after her disabled diabetic Romeo. Then again, maybe her boyfriend couldn't swear she'd been in bed with him all night. Maybe they'd hang Jim's murder on her. It wasn't like they were going to find Jim's suicide note. Kellaway would take it with him and get rid of it somewhere. Or maybe the police would smell a put-up job. But who gave a fuck if they did? Try to prove something. Let him come fishing. He had wriggled off the hook at the mall. He could wriggle out of this. He needed some fresh air and went outside to find some, only there wasn't any. The day stank like an ashtray. It had almost been better inside. Kellaway's thoughts spun like sparks rising from a collapsing fire. He was waiting for them to settle when he heard, almost felt, a faint throb in the air. Fine-grained particles of smoke shivered all around him. The morning was full of strange vibrations and tremors. He tilted his head and listened, heard the distant ringtone of his cell. He tramped to his car, plucked the phone out of the passenger seat. He had missed 7 calls, most of them from Jay Rickles. It was Jay now. He answered.
"Yeah?"
"Where the hell have you been all morning?" Rickles sounded bent.
"I went for a walk. Needed to clear my head."
"Is it clear now?"
"I guess."
"Good, because you got a goddamn mess to figure out. In the next hour, every news channel in the state is going to be running with the story that you pointed a gun at your toddler and threatened to shoot him if your wife ever left you. Do you know how that looks?"
"Where'd you get that story?"
"Where do you think I got the story? I read the fucking transcript from your fucking court proceedings 2 hours ago. I got to it before anyone else did so I could find out what I'm up against. You didn't feel like mentioning any of this to me at any time?"
"Why would I mention something like that, something humiliating like that?"
"Because it was going to come out anyway. Because you sat next to me on TV to tell the world what a big hero you were, taking out a shooter with a gun you had no right to possess."
"Think how lucky it is I didn't follow the injunction. Becky Colbert was just getting started when I walked in."
Rickles took a long, unsteady breath.
"I came back from Iraq with PTSD. I didn't take antidepressants because I didn't want to solve my problems with medication. I never pointed a loaded gun at my son, but I did do things I regret, things I wish I could take back. If I hadn't done them, my child would still be living with me."
A lot of it was true. He had pointed a gun at George once to make a point to Holly, but it wasn't loaded at the time. And for all he knew, he might have PTSD. More came back from Iraq with it than not. He wasn't lying when he said he'd never gotten on antidepressants. He'd never been offered any. For a long time, Rickles didn't reply. When he did, his voice was still husky with emotion, but Kellaway could hear he had calmed down. "And that's what you're going to tell the press today at the candle lighting. You say it just like that."
"You know it's that reporter trying to stir shit," Kellaway said. "The black one. Same one who tried to make your department look bad. People don't believe the blacks can be racist, too, but they can. I could see the way she looked at me. I'm a white man with a gun, and to them, we're all Nazis, to the blacks. She looks at you the same way."
Rickles laughed. "Isn't that the truth? Doesn't matter how many toys for tots I've handed out to little pickaninnies with food stamp mamas and daddies in jail. Black people feel bad about all the things they don't have, and they resent everyone who's made out better. It's never your hard work that got you where you are. It's always the racist system."
"You sure you even still want me to go to the candle lighting?"
Kellaway said.
"Maybe it might be better for you to put distance between the two of us."
"Fuck that," Rickles said, and he laughed again, and Kellaway knew it was all right. "Too late, anyway. We've been on cable news together every night all week. You don't know this yet, but I got an email from a top man at the NRA, and they want us both to deliver a joint keynote speech in Las Vegas next year. Hotel rooms, tickets all paid, $10,000 speaking fee. I spoke to them about the restraining order, and it didn't bother them at all. Far as they're concerned, it just proves the state puts people at risk when they step in to deprive them of their rights." He sighed and then said, "We'll get through it. You're still the good guy in this. Just no more surprises, Kellaway. All right?"
"No more," Kellaway said. "I'll see you at your house in half an hour."
He ended the call and breathed in the scent of char, of sizzling pine cones, stood tall in the smoke of a burning world. After a moment, he tossed the phone back into the passenger seat. He thought that before he got on the road, he might like to grab the Webley and put it in the trunk. Jim didn't need it anymore. Jim didn't need the guns in his garage either. Kellaway decided to take a minute to hunt around, see if there was anything he might want. Jim had said he ought to help himself. 9:44 a.m. "Right here," O'Kellar said, pointing at his feet. They were halfway up the great curving staircase at the center of the Miracle Falls Mall, in a deep well of sunlight, beneath a banked roof of skylights. "I got low and stayed here," O'Kellar said. "Sarah had me texting her every 30 seconds to let her know I was still alive."
"I've been meaning to ask about that," Lantern Glass told him. "Let's walk up the rest of the way. I want to have a look at Devotion Diamonds."
They climbed to the top, all three of them, O'Kello, Lantern Glass, and Dorothy. Lantern Glass had called O'Kello over breakfast to ask if she could read and possibly quote from his text messages to his girlfriend. She did not mention she wanted to look at the time stamps on his messages and see if they revealed when each of the shots had occurred. O'Kello had offered to do her one better.
"The mall is reopening this morning. Going to be candle lighting ceremony at 11.
"I know," Lantern Glass had said. "I was planning to be there to cover it."
"So come by at 9:30 before the stores open up. Meet me at the entrance to boost your game. I can show you my texts and walk you through what I did and what I heard."
"That's no problem."
"You kidding? My little sisters are going nuts about me being in the paper. Total strangers have been asking if they could take selfies with me. I might be getting a taste for fame. I think it suits me."
She'd smiled at that, but had felt a kind of gentle twisting in the chest as well. In that instant, O'Kello sounded very like Coulson. The entrance to Devotion Diamonds was still blocked off by yellow crime scene tape. On the other side of the tape, the doors had been slid shut and locked. The rest of the stores along the gallery were busy, prepping for the 11 o'clock ceremony and the expectation of a curious crowd. Voices yelled and echoed in the big open space of the central atrium. The gate was rolled up at Lids, the hat store next to Devotion Diamonds, and a sleepy-looking stoner with bushy shoulder-length yellow hair was using a sticker gun to put 20% off tags on baseball caps.
"Hats!"
Dorothy cried, squeezing her mother's hand. Dorothy wore a fuzzy yellow chicken-headed hat today, tied under her chin.
"Hats, Mom."
"Mm-hmm," Lantern Glass said. She craned her neck and raised her voice to be heard by the stoner.
"Hey, you mind if my daughter has a wander around?"
"Huh? Sure. Go for it,"
said the stoner, and Dorothy squeezed her mother's fingers again and went leaping into the aisles of lids. O'Keller said,
"Sorry, there isn't really anything to see. But you want to look at my phone?"
He held it out to her.
"I scroll back to my texts from the day of."
Don't go back any further, okay? Lantern Glass said, "Pictures? You know it." O'Keller grinned. "She's out of high school, isn't she?" O'Keller scowled, looked offended.
"She's a year older than me."
"Are you out of high school?"
"I told you I'm in college. College is the reason I work this job. Books don't pay for themselves."
"They pay you plenty, eventually, if you keep at 'em," Lantern Glass said and accepted his phone.
"Holy shit, this girl just walked into Devotion Diamonds and started shooting."
10:37.
"For real? 3 shots?"
10:37.
"What? Where are you? Are you okay?"
10:37.
"On the big staircase, about halfway down. I'm flat on the steps. I'm practically close enough to see what's happening."
10:38.
"Stay down. Can you get away?"
"Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I'm freaking out."
10:38.
"If I go down the stairs, I'd move into sight of anyone standing in the hallway above."
10:39.
"I love you."
10:39.
"I love you too."
10:39.
"Don't move. Stay where you are. Oh, Jesus God, praying so hard right now."
10:39. "You said the person with a gun is a girl. You saw her?"
10:40. "Another hats."
10:40.
"Shot, not hats."
10:40.
Oh, God, please, please, please. I don't want you to get shot."
10:40.
"I'm kind of hoping not to get shot, too."
10:40.
"You idiot. I love you."
10:40.
"Something fell over, and then there was another shot."
10:41.
"Are you all right? You haven't texted."
10:42.
"I'm fine."
10:42.
"Why'd you stop texting?"
10:42.
"I didn't. It's only been a minute."
10:42.
"You scared me. Don't you dare stop texting."
10:42.
"I'm all right."
10:43.
"Still all right."
10:44.
"Shit, another shot."
10:45.
"Oh God, oh God."
10:45.
"I'm not sure what's going on now."
10:46.
"And another shot."
10:46.
"Okay, maybe you should run for it."
10:46.
"I'm all right. I don't want to leave the Frappuccinos."
10:47.
"The what, you asshole?"
10:47.
"I've got Frappuccinos. I can't run with my drinks. I'll spill them."
10:48.
"I hate you so much."
10:49. There was more, but O'Kello didn't mention any other shots. He had the cops arriving and stepping on his hand at 10:52, less than 20 minutes after the first shot was fired, but way too late in the day to change what had happened. The way the St. Pacenti police had it, Becky Colbert had put 3 into her boss and 1 into Mrs. Haswar and her child. Kellaway had entered, fired twice, nailing Colbert once and missing with the second. Then a final shot when Colbert rose up again to shoot Bob Lutz. 7 shots in all. On the time stamp, though, they clustered differently, wrongly. 3, then 2 a bit later, and something fell over. What? The computer, maybe? Then 1, and then 1 more. Lantern Glass had some idea about what that might suggest. but it wasn't anything she could take to press. She wasn't sure Tim Chen would even let her note the discrepancies between Okello's texts and the official report. She gave Okello back his phone and dug her own out of her pocket. "You want screen captures of any of these, that's no problem," he said. Lantern Glass said, "I might. Let me talk to my editor and run a couple of possibilities by him." Dorothy skipped to the threshold of Lids and stopped just inside the security barrier, wearing a raccoon hat with raccoon paws and a raccoon face. Not a Davy Crockett-type cap, more like a raccoon hand puppet that fit on a person's head. "No," Lantern Glass said, and Dorothy's grin vanished, replaced by an ugly scowl.
20% off, Dorothy said.
"No, put it back." Lantern Glass dialed the office. Dorothy said, "I have to pee." "In a minute," Lantern Glass said. "They probably got an employee bathroom out back of Lids," Okello said. He jerked his head at the stoner with bushy hair. "Hey, bruh, you mind if Pokey here runs into your bathroom?" The stoner blinked slowly and said,
"Sure, man, go for it."
Dorothy began to prance back toward Lids.
"No, wait,"
the stoner said in a dreamy sort of tone. He looked as if he had only just been shaken awake.
"Shoot, maintenance is in there. We've been asking them for 3 months to fix the flush. It only took a mass shooting for them to finally find time."
Dorothy gave her mother a wide-eyed, bewildered look.
"What now?"
"Wait," Lantern Glass hissed, just as Tim Chen picked up.
"Aisha," Tim said, no preamble. "You heard."
"Heard what?"
"About the evacuation order."
Tim sounded untroubled, almost mild. "Park Service Fire Department called 40 minutes ago and made it official. We need to clear the office by 10 tomorrow morning."
"You're shitting."
"I never shit," Tim told her.
"You really don't. You're the most constipated man I know."
Tim said, "I need you back here. Everyone's coming in, and I've got Shane Wolf swinging by to pack up our computers. There are trees burning less than a quarter of a mile away, and the wind is picking up."
"We going to lose the building?" she asked.
She was surprised at her own calm, although her anxiety was a smooth, hard weight in the pit of her stomach, like a swallowed stone. "Let's just say they can't promise to save it." Lantern Glass said, "What about the candle lighting ceremony?"
"They'll cover it on TV. We can watch it when we have a chance."
"Are we going to be able to get tomorrow's paper out?" she asked.
When Tim Chen replied, his voice was forceful, almost harsh. She had never heard him say anything in such a tone.
"You bet your ass we will. This paper has come out every weekday since 1937, and I'm not going to be the first editor to let down the team."
"I'll be back as soon as I can get out of here," Lantern Glass promised him. She disconnected, glanced around for her daughter. She expected to find Dorothy back in Lids, digging through the hats, but the little girl was sitting with Okello on a steel bench down the corridor, both of them planted in the very same place Randall Kellaway had settled, almost exactly a week ago, after the shooting in Devotion Diamonds. But someone else had appeared in Lids, a skinny, elderly Asian man in a stained maintenance jumpsuit. He had a dripping wrench in one hand and was waving it at the stoner, muttering in a low, almost angry voice.
"Everything okay?" Lantern Glass asked him.
The maintenance man went silent and turned his stern gaze upon her. The stoner gave her an embarrassed shrug.
"I'll tell you what I told him. The last person to use that toilet," the maintenance man said, wagging his wrench, "left something in it. I think someone needs to take a look at it."
The stoner lifted one hand in a placating gesture.
"And like I said, dude, whatever it is, it wasn't me. Swear to God, I never crap at the mall."
10:28 a.m. When Kellaway steered his Prius into the courtyard of crushed white shells, Jay Rickles was already in the cab of his pickup, sitting in the open door with his feet on the chrome running board. Kellaway got out of his ride and climbed up into the chief's.
"That the same thing you were wearing last night?" Rickles asked, slamming the driver's side door and starting the truck.
Rickles wore a crisp dress uniform, blue jacket with a double row of brass buttons, blue uniform pants with a black stripe down the sides, Glock on his right hip and a black leather holster that looked as if it had been oiled. Kellaway had on a rumpled blue blazer over a polo.
"It's the only thing I've got I can wear on TV,"
Kellaway said. Rickles grunted. He wasn't the grinning, grateful, wet-eyed grandpa today. He looked sunburned and irritable. They took off in a bad-tempered lurch of speed.
"This was supposed to be a hero's welcome," Rickles said. "You know you and I were going to lay a wreath of white roses together."
"I thought we were each just lighting a candle."
"PR thought a wreath would look nice. And the CEO of Sunbelt Marketplace, the guy who manages the Miracle Falls Mall."
"Yeah, I know him. Russ Dorr."
"Yeah, him. He was going to give you a Rolex. I don't know if that's still happening now. People get skittish about pinning medals on wife beaters."
Kellaway said,
"I never touched Holly in my life. Not once in my life."
It was true. It was Kellaway's belief that if you reached a point where you had to use your knuckles on a woman, you had already shamefully lost control of the situation. Rickles slumped a little, then said,
"I'm sorry. I take that back. That was uncalled for."
He paused and said,
"I never pointed a gun at my wife, but I used a belt on my oldest daughter when she was 7.
She wrote her name all over the walls in crayon, and I went ballistic. I snapped my belt at her, and the buckle hit her hand and broke 3 knuckles. That was over 2 decades ago, but it's still fresh in my mind. I was drunk at the time."
"Were you drinking?"
"What, when I threatened her? No. Sober as you are now."
"It would be better if you had been drinking."
Rickles tapped his thumb on the steering wheel. The police scanner under the dash crackled and men talked, calling out codes in lazy, laconic voices.
"I'd give anything to take it back, what I did to my little girl's hand. Most horrible thing? I was blasted and feeling sorry for myself. Defaulted on a loan. Had my car repoed. Hard times. Do you go to church?"
"No."
"You might think about it. There's a part of me that will always carry a bruised heart because of what I did. But I was redeemed through the grace of Jesus, and eventually I found the strength to forgive myself and move on. And now I have all these amazing grandchildren and..."
"Chief," came a voice on the scanner. "Chief, you there?" The chief snagged the mic.
"Rickles here. Go ahead, Martin."
"It's about the thing happening at the mall."
"Did you pick up Kellaway yet?" Martin said. Rickles clapped the mic to his chest and looked at Kellaway's sidelong.
"He's going to tell me you're not getting the Rolex. Do you want to be here or not?" "I guess just say you haven't seen me yet," Kellaway said. "If he tells you I'm not getting a fancy watch, I promise I won't embarrass you by sobbing in the background."
Rickles laughed, a fine web of wrinkles appearing at the corners of his eyes, and for a moment he was his old self.
"I like you, Rand. I always have from the first instant I clapped eyes on you. I hope you know that."
He shook his head, barely clamping down on his mirth, then squeezed the mic.
"No, the son of a bitch hasn't turned up yet. What's the story?"
They were cruising along the highway through a fog of pale blue smoke, maybe 10 minutes from the mall. The wind caught the high pickup and rocked it on its springs.
"Phew," Martin said. "Good. Listen, we've got a real fucking problem down here. A maintenance guy was fixing a toilet out in back of Lids, the shop next to Devotion Diamonds, and you aren't going to believe what he found in the tank. A lead slug. Looks like the one we couldn't locate. The one that took out Mrs. Haswar and her baby. Over."
"How the hell did it get in the toilet? Over."
"Well, didn't someone have to put it there?"
"Gets worse, Chief. That reporter, Lantern Glass, she was right there. She heard all about it. What's the bet it's all over TV by lunch? Over." While Martin was blabbing, Kellaway reached across the seat and unbuttoned the chief's holster. Rickles glanced down as Kellaway pulled out the Glock and stuck the barrel in his ribs.
"Tell him to head to my house and that you'll meet him there, then hang up," Kellaway said.
Rickles held the mic in his hand, staring down with clear, surprised blue eyes at the gun in his side.
"And watch the road,"
Kellaway added, as Rickles looked up and braked hard to keep from rear-ending a Caprice dawdling along through the smoke. Rickles squeezed the mic.
"Jesus, okay. What a fucking mess. We better convene at Kellaway's house. He hasn't turned up at my place, so he's probably still there. First officers on the scene should hold him. I'm putting on my party lights and heading that way now. Out."
He released the mic and hung it on the scanner.
"Pull over in that gas station," Kellaway said. "The shell up on the right. I'm going to let you out and drop you off. Because I like you too, Jay. You've never been nothing but generous to me."
Rickles touched his blinker and began to slow. His face was stiff, impassive. "Yasmin Haswar? And the boy, Ibrahim? That was you?" he asked.
"It was the last thing in the world I ever meant to happen," Kellaway said. "They say that guns don't kill people, that people kill people. But I feel like the gun wanted the both of them. I really do. Yasmin Haswar leapt up out of nowhere like she knew there was a bullet waiting for her, and the gun went off. Sometimes guns do kill people."
The truck pulled into a parking lot containing 8 rows of pumps and a small central convenience store. At that time of the morning, most of the pumps were empty. A film of blue smoke rippled steadily across the lot, coursing over the roof of the tiny mini-mart. The truck's blinker was still click-click-clicking.
"What a pile of shit," Rickles said. "You asshole. You careless asshole. Guns don't just go off."
"Don't they?"
Kellaway asked, and shot him.
10:41 a.m.
He unbuckled Rickles' seatbelt and pulled him sideways, so the stout little man dropped across the front seat. Then Kellaway got out and went around to the driver's side and hauled himself up behind the wheel. The driver's side window was mucked with blood and tissue, as if someone had thrown a great fistful of pink slime against the glass. He pushed Rickles over to make more room, and the older man slipped and fell into the passenger side footwell. Only his feet remained tangled up on the seat. A guy had come out of the convenience store, a 50-something dude with long graying hair and a Lynyrd Skynyrd tee beneath an unbuttoned flannel shirt. Kellaway lifted a hand in a casual wave, and the guy nodded back and stuck a cigarette in his mouth. Maybe he'd heard the shot and come out for a look. Maybe he just wanted a smoke. No one else gave the pickup a second look. It wasn't like on TV. People didn't register what they heard, didn't process what they saw. Busy pedestrians might walk by a dead homeless man for hours, assuming he was asleep. Kellaway steered back toward Jay's house and away from the life he'd lived for the last 15 years. He thought his chances of escape were very slim, although he had a few things working in his favor. Those things were in his Prius. One of them was loaded with a banana clip. He pulled into the courtyard of Rickles' hacienda and parked the truck. As he climbed down, the front door opened and the tow-headed boy named Merritt stood there gazing blankly out at him. Kellaway nodded, "How you doing?" and walked swiftly to his Prius with Chief Rickles' Glock in his hand. He tossed it under the passenger seat of his car and got out of there. When he looked in the rearview mirror, the kid had turned his head to stare at his grandfather's pickup. Maybe he was wondering why there was crap all over the inside of the driver's side window. A gust of wind tried to shove the Prius out of its lane and onto the dirt embankment, and Kellaway had to struggle with the wheel to stay on the blacktop. Smoke churned around him as he drove west. If he moved quickly and didn't hesitate, he thought there might be time to get George away from Holly and the sister-in-law. He had a boat, a little 18-footer with an outboard. In happier days, he'd sometimes taken George fishing in it, He had a notion to get the boy and make a run for the Bahamas. They could hide out in the rocks off Little Abaco, maybe eventually work their way south to Cuba. It was 200 miles or more to Freeport on Grand Bahama Island, and he doubted he'd ever been more than 3 miles out in the boat. But he wasn't afraid of the deep swell, or of drifting off course and slow roasting to death under the equatorial sun, or of capsizing and drowning with his child. It seemed to him far, far more likely that the Coast Guard would find him offshore, and a sniper in a helicopter would blow his brains out while little George watched. If they could hit him in the chop, if he didn't hit them first. Besides, they might stay back if they weren't sure what he'd do to the kid. He'd never point a loaded gun at his child, but from a helicopter, how could you tell if a gun was loaded or not? The boulevards were wide and open, but the farther west he went, the less imposing the houses became. Modest one-floor ranches drifted toward him out of the haze and slipped away again. The makes of other cars were almost unidentifiable in the filthy murk. Headlights bobbed up out of the soup and sailed past, attached to shadows. In the movies, the man with a license to kill pressed a button and released a cloud of smoke from the back end of his Aston Martin to blind his pursuers and make an escape. Kellaway was stuck with a Prius instead of a British sports car, but his smoke cover was much more effective. Francis's silver BMW wagon was in the driveway, parked nose into the garage, so Kellaway could read the coexist sticker on the back end. He pulled in right behind it, blocking her, and got out. The wind sheared across the lawn, and his eyes stung in the billowing smoke. Kellaway held the Glock in one hand. He popped the hatchback of his Prius and threw aside the sleeping bag that covered the weapons he'd lifted from Jim Hurst's garage. He considered the Bushmaster, the Webley, and the .45, then picked up the single-barrel Mossberg with the pistol grip. He loaded it with PDX-1 rounds, squeezed 5 in the tube, 1 in the chamber. The matte finish on the gun barrel was a flawless black. It looked as if it had never been fired. Kellaway cut across the front yard, headed for the door. Francis's ranch was guacamole green, the walls all rough, spiky stucco. She had cacti for border plantings, which he thought fit her personality. The front door was flanked by tall, narrow sidelights with cheap white panel curtains. As he approached, he saw one of the curtains twitch. He couldn't tell who'd been watching him, Holly or Francis, but just as he reached the door, he heard the bolt turn. It was almost funny. The idea that she thought she could lock him out. He lowered the Mossberg and pulled the trigger, and the shotgun went off with a thunderous slam and blew a hole through the lock and the wood surrounding it. He planted his boot in the center of the door and shoved, and it flew open, and he followed it in and almost stepped on George. Along with a fist-sized chunk of the door, the Mossberg had blown away the upper right half of George's face and a large portion of his skull. A splinter the size of a kitchen knife had gone through his left eye. The boy opened and closed his mouth, gurgling strangely. Kellaway could see his brain, glistening pinkly. It seemed to pulse, to beat, not unlike a heart. George tried to say something, but could make only wet smacking sounds. Kellaway looked down at him in perplexity. It was like an optical illusion. Something that didn't make sense to the eye. Holly stood 6 feet away, holding a cell phone up to her cheek. She wore white slacks and a sleeveless green blouse, and her hair was turbaned in a towel. Like George, she was opening and closing her mouth without making any sound. The shot seemed to go off again, and then again, only inside Kellaway, in his head. He was screaming for a while before he realized it. He didn't know when he dropped to one knee. He didn't know when he set aside the Glock to put a hand gently on his son's chest. Time just skipped forward, and he found himself bent over his child. Time skipped again, and Holly was kneeling by George's head, cupping the red ruin of his skull in her hands. Blood squirted on her white pants. George had stopped trying to talk. Holly had put the phone down next to her knee, and someone on the other end was saying, "Hello?
Miss? Hello? A 911 operator, calling to them from another galaxy.
Kellaway took another deep breath and found he was done screaming. His throat was ragged and sore. He kept his hand on his son's chest, had slipped it under his shirt to place a palm against his warm skin. He could feel George's heart beating rapidly, a furious, frightened stammer in his chest. He could feel when it stopped. Holly wept, tears plinking onto George's face. George's expression was stunned and blank.
"You told him to lock me out,"
Kellaway said to her. It seemed incredible to him that his son had been alive and complete less than 2 minutes ago, and now, abruptly, was dead, his face obliterated. It was too sudden to make sense.
"No,"
Francis said. Francis stood in the living room on the other side of a pony wall. She held a vase in one hand. He assumed she had heroic notions of smashing it over his skull, but she seemed unable to move. All of them were stuck in place, shocked by the non sequitur of George dying in a single shot.
"He saw you coming before any of us. He saw you coming, and he was scared," Francis said. She was quivering. "You had a gun."
"I still do, you foolish cunt," Kellaway said.
It turned out Francis's fag of a husband, Elijah, was hiding in the bedroom. By the time Kellaway found him, the shotgun was empty. He had put 3 into Francis and 2 into Holly when she tried to run out the door. But there were still 14 rounds in the Glock, and he needed only 1 before his work was done.
11:03 a.m.
He might have sat with George forever. He went over it again and again in his head, what should have happened. In his mind, Kellaway crossed the front yard to the door and blew a hole through the lock and shoved the door in, and George was there, but fine, ducked down, hands over his head. Kellaway scooped him up in one arm and leveled the shotgun at Holly as he backed out the door. "You had your turn with him, now it's mine." Or try this. He crossed the yard to the front door and blew a hole through the lock and Francis's stomach at the same time. She was the one standing on the other side of it, not George. Why would it be George? That didn't make any sense. Why would George be afraid of him? He imagined crossing the yard to the front door, and George threw it open before he could get there and ran to him, yelling, "Daddy!" arms open wide. That was how it was when George and Holly still lived with him. George yelled, "Daddy!" whenever he got home from work, as if he hadn't seen him for months instead of just hours, and always came running. What brought Kellaway up and out of his thoughts was the sound of someone saying his name in the next room in a low, distant voice. He wondered if Francis was not dead, although he didn't see how she could still be alive. Her guts were all over the carpet. 2 blasts from the shotgun had all but cut her in half, just above the waist. He'd been holding George's small hand. It was already cold. The extremities cooled off so quickly once circulation ceased, and now he folded it across the boy's small, slight chest and stood. Frances was splayed on her back on the other side of the pony wall. Where her stomach belonged was a red and black slime of mutilated intestines. A 3rd shot had ripped a hole in the left side of her neck. It looked like her throat had been partly torn out by an animal. He supposed, in some ways, this was exactly what had happened, and he was the animal. It wasn't Holly saying his name, either. Holly had fled into the kitchen, where she was now lying face down, arms stretched out over her head, like a child pretending to be flying. He had gotten her in the heart, which was where she had gotten him, too. The voice he heard was coming from the TV. A stern, dark-haired news anchor was saying that a lead slug had been found hidden in a toilet, and that the discovery threw Randall Kellaway's story into serious doubt. The newsman said the candlelighting ceremony had been canceled abruptly with no explanation. He said the disturbing new evidence had been confirmed by a reporter with the Digest. The news anchor said the reporter's name, and Kellaway said it too, very quietly,
Why had George been afraid of him? Because Aisha Lanternglass told him to be. She'd been telling the world for days that Kellaway was a scary person. Maybe not explicitly, but it was hinted at.